This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to This Week in FCPA, episode 105 for the week ending June 1, 2018, the We're Still Number One edition. First, a word about our sponsor, Affiliated Monitors. Founded in 2004, Affiliated Monitors provides professional independent integrity monitoring and ethics and compliance assessments nationally and internationally and across all industries. With its knowledge of effective ethics and compliance programs and cultures, Affiliated Monitors is respected for its work as the corporate monitor on matters ranging from multinational corporations to small and mid-sized companies and even individuals. Having served in over 700 monitorships, no one has more experience as an independent monitor than the team at Affiliated Monitors. For more information on how an independent monitor can help improve your company's ethics and compliance programs, visit our sponsor's website, www.affiliatedmonitors.com. In today's episode, Jay and I took a wide-ranging look at several compliance topics. We review the GDPR commentary after its go-live date of May 25. We consider modernizing compliance, a viewpoint from the front lines. We take a look at an article by Jonathan Marks on the parameters of third-party due diligence on the supply chain side of things. We consider Roseanne, her termination from IABC, and what it means for the compliance practitioner. We take a look at how texting can expose your company to both compliance and legal liability. We note that Fund Leg Mason reserved $67 million for an FCPA settlement. Mike Volkoff says that compliance officers need to up their game in a very provocative blog post entitled Compliance and the Reckoning, which we discuss. And we consider the limitations on big data and compliance programs. We have a wide-ranging discussion. I know you'll enjoy it. This is Tom Fox. Thank you very much for listening to This Week in FCPA. This Week in FCPA is a part of the Compliance Podcast Network. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 105 of This Week in the FCPA, the week ending June 1, 2018, the We're Still Number One edition. Together with Mr. Monitors, Jay Rosen, we are back for another week of looking at some of the top compliance and ethics stories. So, Jay, we had a pretty interesting week, I thought. First of all, we will note that the Complete Compliance Handbook still sits at number one in the rankings, Amazon's business new releases in business and ethics. So that is the reason for the title of this episode. But we also had a really interesting week in ethics and compliance. So you want to just jump right into it?
Yeah. Last Friday, the GDPR directive came into force, and this shoots up to our number one on the list of topics. So, Tom, tell us what people have been talking about with regards to GDPR.
So, yeah, that was a great intro, Jay. And I guess the commentary since that time has really been, if not confusion, perhaps questions. Questions on how it's going to be enforced, what are the regulations. We've got 28 different regulators, how they will coordinate with each other, if at all. Who will be in charge of enforcement? Really lots of questions. The commentary prior to GDPR was focused more on how do you comply with the new law, and now there seem to be questions. And a couple of those questions that I thought were significant for the compliance practitioner were one raised by Ben DiPietro in the Wall Street Journal Risk and Compliance Report, where he asked, or at least raised the question, that GDPR is fuzzy on whistleblower rules. And this is something that every compliance practitioner, I think, needs to think about, certainly within the context of their own whistleblower program. What personal identifying information do you have? How is it stored? How long do you need it? All of those questions, plus the any anonymous tips that come in, how are you going to deal with those? It's really potentially a steep set of penalties if you get it wrong. So compliance practitioners need to really be cognizant of compliance and non-compliance around GDPR for whistleblowers. The next, Jay, was a, I thought, an interesting angle that I had frankly not thought about, which was an article by Cheryl O'Neill, who is the Director of Product Management at Seal Software, which she entitled "Contracts Are a Hidden GDPR Risks." And in her article, she considered the hidden risks contracts pose for compliance, and then why technology, machine learning, and AI may be a key way to get actionable visibility into information which is in contracts. And the question she raised, Jay, is, do you have GDPR sensitive personal identifying information in your contracts? And are your contracts GDPR compliant? Recognizing that if you're a major international, multinational company with operations literally across the world, particularly in Europe, so that you're subject to GDPR, how are you going to review all of those contracts? And that was really the AI technology and machine learning angle she posited, that you could run large numbers of contracts with the keyword searches or other words that you, if you develop a data bank. I recognize that that may be a little bit more in your wheelhouse as the former Mr. Translations before you became Mr. Monitors. But I thought it was a really interesting angle that I had really not considered, of just a traditional commercial contract, business to business, between two multi-billion multinational companies, yet there may be GDPR implications. And even if they're not implications, she certainly advocates that you consider that possibility and review contracts. So lots of questions about GDPR. Where it goes at this point, no one knows.
And with those questions, I think you have a lot of opportunity to. And hearkening back to my days as Mr. Translations, you know, when we were helping out on all these investigations, e-discovery was really such, you know, such a category that ate all those costs. And it's basically that same technology that in e-discovery, you're trying to leverage AI to find a relevant set of documents and maybe only, you know, go through 5% of your hundreds or millions of pages of docs. And this is almost the similar application for the e-discovery technology, but with a different aim here, trying to figure out whose personal identifiable information you have. So I think the technologists are going to be able to come in, and you know, it does seem overwhelming, but as they say, you know, how do you eat an apple now? How do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Next up, we've got an article from Jacqueline Jaeger, your colleague over at Compliance Week, and she has a nice little wrap up of basically how you modernize compliance in a viewpoint from the front line. This was taken from one of the panels that we sat in, and we spoke about this a little bit last week when Wei Chen was asked about who she would have on her team to build an ethics and compliance department. And she had remarked that she would hire data scientists, auditors, social scientists, journalists, and marketers and engineers. So she really took a look at trying to have a cross-functional collaborative team to work on this. And there were definitely similar comments from the folks who were there. Another thing that she said that a lot of people may not really take into account is that it's good to have the policies and the procedures and, you know, people taking training, but there's really no substitute for getting out on the shop room floor or getting out on the front lines and talking to people and see how you're compliance rules actually fit into the business rules. And compliance people might be good at speaking compliance, but they sometimes can need a little shoring up in speaking business. So if you can get out there and talk to the functional departments and you know, really learn what's happening out in your business areas, you can be a more effective ethics and compliance leader. And then the last part of this article, we talked about using some kind of I guess, gamification. And there was something where they actually tried to entice people to pick the wrong answer, and they had a virtual jail, and pretty quickly that jail filled up by all your all the people who were doing the simulation. So if your employees make the wrong choices in a room playing a game, think about what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. So a great article by Jacqueline, and we're linking to it in the show notes.
So next up, Jonathan Marks posted a article around third-party due diligence. And Jay, why I wanted to bring this up was obviously third-party risks are still the greatest risk in the anti-corruption compliance space around the FCPA. I think that's well recognized in the compliance profession. Yet, I think it's always good to have a review of third-party due diligence. What is third-party due diligence? How do you do it? And the process to go through it. And I think Jonathan has done a great service by posting this article, and he basically lays out what you need to do, which is he focused on suppliers on the supply side, but he said you do a risk assessment, and then you figure out from there really what your categories of suppliers are. And he broke it down into four categories: high-risk suppliers, low-risk suppliers, suppliers of goods and services in a low-risk country, and then low-risk suppliers of goods, general goods and products, so that things that are everyone sort of buys and supplies can be given the lowest level of risk. What this does, Jay, is it really gives you a way to focus on, particularly in the supply chain where you can have tens of thousands of companies contracted to your business, a way to think through how to get your arms around it and how to perform an accurate level of due diligence, or set up categories so you can perform an accurate level of due diligence. And when a regulator comes knocking, you can show them the process, then you can show them who you've looked at in the due diligence. So, you know, kudos to Jonathan for putting this out there to remind us about this. So, Jay, next we had a story from your former world of entertainment, although this is from the world of television. I think you would probably not have stooped so low as to work in television, being the high-minded, high-flying movie screenwriter that you formerly were. But we had some really, I thought, incredibly racist and vile comments by Roseanne, and a termination, if not instantaneously, literally within hours, ABC canceled her show. So what does all that mean for the compliance professional from your perspective?
Well, it's just really, you know, this has been the story of the week, and it's completely snowballed out there. There's a great podcast that you and Matt Kelly did on compliance into the weeds. And Matt just really wrote a very succinct and powerful analysis of the situation, which we link to in the show notes. And basically, with social media, once you put something out there, you can't bring it back. You know, you can delete it, but people will have screenshots, people will have read it. And, you know, Matt just spoke about the vile tweet that Roseanne set out, and it's really been on the forefront of everyone's mind. And, you know, we often talk about having a disaster preparedness plan and what you do. And Matt's point, one of the points he made, is that when Bob Iger woke up on the Tuesday morning after Labor Day, the last thing he thought he was going to be doing is having to pull a top-rated show off the air and fire the star. And this has just created lots of backlash. Samantha Bee on TBS had an unflattering term, which he referred to the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump. Keith Olbermann has been a fervent critic of the president and has used nasty terms to decide him. So there really is a lack of decorum out there. And this all falls into something that when your company goes live on social media, whereas if you're Starbucks and you have an issue with racial profiling, that gets snapped up on Facebook. It gets released out into the world. And at this point, you have lost your ability to investigate, to game plan, to figure out what you're going to do. ABC and Starbucks were both put in very reactive positions. And at that point, you have to hope that your leadership has the right ethics to make the proper call. And Matt also pointed out that it was kind of ironic that this whole thing came down the day that Starbucks was doing their training of their personnel and they closed down all their U.S. stores. So this is going to continue to add fuel to the fire. It took the president several days to actually opine on this. And now we're going to see this battle fought out on the tweets and on the internet. So great podcast by you and Matt and great article by him. What are your thoughts on this, Tom?
So the lesson I would ask compliance practitioners to consider is one of the things you alluded to, which is the accelerant of social media. I think it's well known if you put it out on social media, it's there really forever, whether you delete it or not. But social media also accelerates the length or length of time that something can becomes a thing and reverse amount of time that you have to make a decision. So here we had ABC, literally Bob Iger, I think he made it at 2 p.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern time, that's 12 Pacific. This really hit the social media world about 7 or 8 a.m. So that's how fast ABC had to make a decision. Two things for the compliance professional. One is your disaster management and perhaps disaster recovery do not anticipate working at the speed of social media, which is essentially the speed of light. You may need to rethink that. I used to say that if your name is on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Financial Times, that's what you need to avoid. Well, now if something about your company becomes a thing in social media, that's what can really be terrifying. So you have to have a mechanism to get that information to your decision makers with as much information as you can to allow them to make a business call. Second, what are your values and then your priorities? If the value you hold is that you will not countenance with either your employees or those whose products you show or TV shows you put up will engage in violent racist comment, you need to be able to respond to that. So the value that ABC showed and the priority it put off its watchers and listeners and consumers long before its business partners and its advertisers raised a hue and cry, I think really spoke to the values and then the priority of ABC. So having those discussions, having that information in place, I think is going to be critical going forward. I don't know if ABC did, or they just made this up on the fly, but by getting out ahead of this, by making the decision they did, which seemed to be in line with both their viewership and most probably their advertisers, I think they were able to limit the damage to ABC, the president's nonsensical tweets notwithstanding.
All right. Next up, we've got another technical article from Corporate Compliance Insights. And tell us what Mike Pagini thinks about how texting can affect your company from a legal liability perspective.
So, Jay, similar to the question that Cheryl O'Neill raised in GDPR around are contracts a hidden risk, I thought this article really raised some interesting questions about an issue we don't really think about a lot, which is, can text messaging expose your company to significant risk? So in the first area of risk, if you think back to the new FCPA corporate enforcement policy announced by Rod Rosenstein in late November 2017, he specifically, the new policy specifically required companies to keep messaging services and messaging apps which may self-delete messages to somehow capture those for regulators. But here, I thought the author took it really a step further, that companies need to have a mechanism in place that text messages will be kept in a searchable format that cannot be tampered with, destroyed, or otherwise disposed of by anyone deliberately or even accidentally. So that really speaks to that issue. The second issue, though, that I had not really considered is the legal, or rather the compliance risk in terms of what the new FCPA corporate enforcement policy had, but also legal risk too, just regular old civil lawsuits, things that your former folks at Merrill may have helped companies do translations around, electronically stored information, and courts are now demanding that as a part of a discovery in an e-discovery filing or response to request. So you have to be proactive with your text messaging compliance and risk mitigation. And so I really wanted to call this out because many of the things that you may not think of as potentially giving rise to legal or compliance liability, particularly when a company has a bring your own device policy that is used for corporate or business work, you need to think through that and have a policy in place for that.
And, you know, the corollary to that is that you all have all these different types of data formats and data streams. So you have to be able to both capture the structured as well as the unstructured data and be able to have one single repository where all those things can be accessed very quickly in the name of e-discovery. So, you know, there is more and more technology out there. It is all closing in on us, and there's no excuses now. People have been warned, and I think this is a timely article, especially with the tweet that went around the world today, this week, that this is something that you need to prepare for. Not to worry, there still is stuff happening in the FCPA world. And this week, Legg Mason put an update in their latest 10K form, and they said that they are setting aside a reserve for an FCPA investigation. Back in 2005 to 2007, they had acquired a group called Permal Group, and Permal did some money fund management for Libya and Gaddafi. And if this sounds familiar, this is a similar situation that OCSIF had, that they had also done some funding for the Libyan Investment Authority. What Legg Mason has done is they've set aside a reserve of $67 million, and that accounts for $31 million that Permal earned from the Libya business. So we're going to be on the lookout for this to come in the next quarter or so, and we should see whether or not this cooperative Legg Mason was going to be, and whether they get a declination or whether there is a monitor. So this is something that we will be following from the FCPA world.
Right, Jay, and I really appreciated your reference to OCSIF because we'd heard that private equity was going to be kind of in the sights now, and this fund manager Legg Mason with their announcement really, I think, confirms that. We don't know how many others might be down the road, but for companies that did business in Libya in that time frame, if you haven't taken a look at your operations, you certainly need to do so.
Next up, our good friend Mike Volkov writes about compliance and the reckoning. What's Mike thinking about?
So this was, I thought, a very provocative piece, Jay, and a very thought-provoking from Mike. He writes a lot of nuts and bolts, kind of into the weeds pieces, but this was not one of those. I thought this was much more thought-provoking, much more controversial. He basically said that the compliance profession and compliance practitioners have been put on a pedestal over the past 10 years or so because of increased enforcement actions by the government. Companies are understanding the need for obviously have understood the need for compliance, and that as the compliance profession has risen up, he fears that they are about to be hit. And he notes that once you're on the pedestal, there's only one way to go, and that's down. And the hit, he means, is if there is a violation after a company spends a lot of money to put in place a best practices compliance program, hires a high profile or high flying CCO, they're going to be asked if there's a violation, what happened? And the problem is that no compliance program could ever completely protect you from untoward activity by employees, because simply that there's going to be people involved in your compliance program. So he advocates really a couple of things. One is education, to make sure senior execs and a board of directors understand that. But equally importantly, and I thought as part of that education, though, was to give training to separate and apart from explaining compliance, give training to compliance to boards and senior leadership on their roles, so that both boards, CEOs and senior management all have a very good understanding of what compliance is, what it can do, and frankly, their roles in setting tone and oversight. So a very interesting, thought-provoking and provocative article by Mike. And as always, great stuff.
Did I also read correctly, Tom, that another constituency that Mike thought needed to be educated in the ways of compliance is our legal representatives in Congress? Because they also can, I think, learn from the fact that it's just not going to be because you have a code and a program that that's going to stop things. And if Congress is legislating laws that affect our businesses, I think they also need to have an understanding of the limits and the applicability of how compliance and ethics affect the modern business.
Yes, that's correct. He had an entire section on the congressional issue, and Mike has been on the Hill. He's been on the Judiciary Committee as a staffer, and he understands that those people really know little or nothing about compliance, and certainly Congress knows nothing about compliance. And so there really needs to be an effort by, I think, a couple of different groups. One is the regulators who do understand compliance, whether that be the DOJ or the SEC or other regulatory department or agency, but it also has to be an effort from the compliance profession. The compliance profession needs to educate Congress. They need to put out white papers explaining what compliance is. One of the criticisms, I think, fair criticisms of the compliance profession as a whole in the Digital Realty Trust versus Summers U.S. Supreme Court case was there was no unified or even response from the compliance community, no amicus brief filed, no opinions or any information from the compliance community about why a compliance program, someone who reports internally, needs to have whistleblower protection. That was completely missing from information provided to the Supreme Court. So hopefully we can get that information in front of Congress. But once again, great post by Mike.
Yeah. So our concluding article comes from the Risk and Compliance Journal. Henry Cutter talks about the limits of big data. And this past Wednesday in New York City, Clearlight Advisors held its 2018 Compliance Summit in New York. And one of the things that they were saying is that you can use big data to help inform what the risks are, but they can't use data alone to get to the risks. So you have to talk to people, you have to be there, and you show them that you saw the data and get their thoughts as well. And Scott Lane from the Red Flag Group was on the panel, and he said, data can be used to potentially validate and identify seriousness of risks and to perhaps predict when the risk is going to happen, but looking at the data to identify the risk is a fallacy. So, you know, if we get any themes from today's podcast, data is out there and AI is out there and it can be used, but there are always limits to the efficacy. So it takes part of compliance and ethics professionals understanding their business, understanding their risk, whether they're third parties, whether they're risks of dealing with foreign governments. But once you understand that, data can help you potentially hone in and use your information and look for where the problems are. But data is not the answer alone. Data can't live by itself, but data, when used intelligently, can help you make better decisions. And you have to take that data, and you also have to marry it with the human element.
Absolutely. So we had some untoward sports news, last weekend now. One last week and one this week, Saturday and Sunday, when our beloved Rockets/Celtics gagged on the big one, lost conference finals, Game 7 conference finals at home. About the only thing I can say is the Celtics' absolutely pathetic three-point shooting was only exceeded by Houston's even more abysmal three-point shooting. But Jay, on a much more upbeat note, we have the two best teams in baseball playing this weekend in Houston, which are the Astros and the Red Sox. And I'm pleased to note that the Astros won last night. Nevertheless, some great baseball. And we've now got an NBA Finals. So we had Game 1 last night where Cleveland was the better team for 47 minutes and 55 seconds of the game. Unfortunately, a game lasts 48 minutes. And so Cleveland lost because of their conduct in the last 5 seconds. So the NBA Finals, fourth straight one for the Cavs and Warriors. And we didn't get to see the Rockets-Celtics 86 rematch that we were all hoping for.
Next year for that one. But tell me, what was going through J.R. Smith's mind when he got that rebound?
Well, it's hard to say. Jalen Rose this morning on ESPN said he thought he needed to be drug tested, as in now, as in right after that 5 seconds. It's just absolute stunning that a 13 or 12 year professional, who absolutely steals an offensive rebound off a missed free throw with 5 seconds left would either not know or forget that the score is tied, dribbling the ball, to run timeout when he had a wide open LeBron James getting ready to, who could have at least got a shot off for Cleveland to win that. And that all turns on the fellow who shot the free throw, Greg Smith, clanked off a free throw with 5 seconds left that would have put Cleveland ahead by at least one point, where they might have hung on from that. So whereas the Rockets were great for the first half of games 6 and 7, leading by as many as 20 points, Cleveland led up till 47-55. And then gagged on it and lost in overtime. So I'm predicting sweep. I don't know how you feel about it, but at least there's some good baseball going on.
I don't know. I mean, it really is a shot, a dagger through the heart to lose that way. But LeBron seems possessed. He is just playing some great basketball out there. So you never know. I don't think this is a sweep. But it may go 5 or 6, but I think it's going to take a lot of metal to come back from that loss last night. So we got the sports thing out of the way. Tell us what's happening in Houston July 21st and 22nd, Tom.
So, Jay, actually, I have a couple of upcoming events in Houston I wanted to talk about. The first one is, as you've noted on actually, that's not July. That's June. So let's.
Oh, sorry. I'm only as good as the script I get.
I know, you just can't get good help anymore, can you? June 21 and 22, Thursday and Friday, I'm putting on a new masterclass, compliance masterclass, going to be held here in Houston at the law firm of Ware Jackson. I've got links to the information, registration information available. And in this masterclass, you will learn about compliance from the guy who wrote the book on compliance, and that's me. The next week on June 28th, I'm actually having a book signing. And in the support your local booksellers category, I'm having a book signing at the River Oaks Bookstore. So if you're in Houston on June 28th, hope you'll drop by and purchase a copy, and let me put a John Henry or Tom Fox on it for you. As we noted, a complete compliance handbook remains number one in Amazon's new releases in the business ethics category. You can pick it up on Amazon, or if you want an autographed copy, you can get it directly from me. And then, Jay, I'm very pleased to announce a podcast series next week on the topic of suspension and debarment with your colleague, Rod Grandin. Had the opportunity to interview Rod over a 5-podcast series, and we're really going to take a deep dive into suspension and debarment. I frankly thought I knew what that was, and it turns out that I was a little bit off base. So it's really significant for the compliance practitioner to learn about these two tools that the government has, how they use them, why they're different than both civil and criminal enforcement from the Department of Justice and Securities and Exchange Commission, how it works, what the remedies are, and how you go through this procedure. So I'm very excited. Had a great interview with Rod Grandin, and Rod's a former chief suspension and debarment, suspending and debarring officer of the Air Force. So lots of experience, and certainly something that I think every compliance practitioner needs to be aware of.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that, Tom. So thank you so much. And we will have that available on all of Tom's outlets. It'll be on the Affiliated Monitor website. And you can bet we'll shoot it all over LinkedIn and Twitter. So I think that wraps up the month of May. And now we're in June. And who knows what other compliance, ethics, and FCPA surprises we have coming our way. But on behalf of Tom Fox, the compliance evangelist, and myself, Jay Rose, and Mr. Monitor, we'd like to thank you for joining us for this week in FCPA episode 105. We're still number one edition, and let's see if we can make this 3 weeks in a row for next week. So thanks so much for living for listening, and have yourself a great weekend.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox again. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of This Week in FCPA. If you have any questions, you can email me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. You can email Jay at jrosen@affiliatedmonitors.com. I hope you have enjoyed this episode, and I hope you'll join us again next week for another episode of This Week in FCPA. This Week in FCPA is a part of the Compliance Podcast Network. If you have listened to this podcast on iTunes, I'd greatly appreciate it if you would rate our podcast. It would help in our rankings and help get the word out about the only weekly wrap-up of all things compliance and ethics. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next week.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.